Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper, I have no idea what day it is. It's January 14th?
Yes, it's January 14th.
2018.
That's the easy one.
Yeah. And this is episode number 52.
Yes, 1 year.
So we've been doing this for a whole year.
Full year.
We have a special guest today, Ellie Suttmeyer. Hello, Ellie.
Hello, thank you for having me.
And so she's going to sit in and we're going to, you know...
Ellie's here because she's our engineer and she was here on our initial podcast.
Yes, and we want this to be an extra special good podcast.
Plus we're getting the whole gang together from the very beginning, going way back 52 podcasts ago.
The loyal members.
Exactly.
The initiators.
The ones who are going to benefit from the IPO when we make it big.
All right, so for those of you who don't remember or don't know, the premise of this podcast comes from old-time radio shows. Old-time as in 40s and 50s. Yeah. And a couple of AM stations. There were actually couples who broadcast from their apartments reading the newspaper. Pagin and Ed Fitzgerald, Dorothy Kilgallen and her husband Dick, etc. And so to give us some kind of foothold in subject matter for a podcast, we base it on what we read in the newspaper, mostly the weekend newspapers.
Right, and we just talk about what we've read.
And we don't pretend to be experts. We talk about things that tickle our fancy.
I pretend to be an expert sometimes.
But mostly we're enthusiasts.
Yes.
And we're just going to talk about the things that we enjoy reading about.
And talking about. Right, exactly.
And we encourage you to... listen as much as you can. We encourage you to follow us.
Right. When things go off the rails, curse, because we'll talk later about that's
the advantages of that. Encourage your friends.
Encourage your friends.
To listen to.
Right.
Okay, we need listeners.
We need listeners. We want
that interaction.
Exactly.
We want this to be a conversation.
Right.
So you can yell back at us.
Exactly. And we do get some feedback, and it is good to get feedback.
So what's going on this week in...
In the world. Well, we're looking forward to the Olympics coming up.
Oh, really? We are?
Well, not really, honestly. But the Olympics are set to start.
I'm looking forward to the Olympics.
There you go.
I love the Olympics.
Ellie chimes in.
The Winter Olympics. You like them especially?
I truly love the Winter Olympics.
Really?
And I don't like sports at all.
I thought it was just NBC.
Which things do you like? Are you one of those people...
First of all, let's get clear. February 9th, okay? Starts February 9th.
And which events do you like?
I like the skiing.
Oh, okay.
I like curling.
Curling. We know some curlers.
And honestly, I'll just watch whatever is on.
Well, that's the spirit, because that's what it takes, that kind of attitude to get through some of the sports.
There was one year when there were some Winter Olympics going on, and we had some snow out.
Yeah.
And Dan and I would go out when he came home from work. In the dark, you can ski. In the open fields of Cranberry, right? So we would go out, we'd do like an hour of cross-country skiing in the fields behind our house and in the woods over there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then we'd come back in, turn on the Olympics, and we felt like we were with our people. You know, we were part of the Olympics.
Okay.
So that was very fun.
Well, maybe we'll snow again. Who knows? But, the thing about the Olympics... a couple of things that came to mind about the Olympics, and it was prompted by the fact that there were two obituaries this week. By total coincidence, two stalwarts of the 1952 Summer Olympics, Horace Aschenfelter and Cy Young. And if those names don't mean anything to you, that's part of the point. Horace Aschenfelter won the 3,000-meter steeplechase in the 52 Olympics, and he was much acclaimed. He was a national hero. Cy Young... won the javelin in the 1952 Olympics. Same deal. Huge hero, huge reception.
Not related to the pitcher, Cy Young.
And in both cases, these are significant wins because they were unprecedented from the U.S. side and they'd never been matched. We've never won in the 3,000-meter steeplechase in the U.S. since. We haven't run the javelin since. So these were singular accomplishments. And yet, in both cases... both men who lived to be a ripe old age, unknown now and really unknown for the last 30, 40 years. And in both cases, the way their lives were lived was consistent with that. They won the Olympics. They both took a shot at the next Olympics. They didn't do particularly well. And then went into private life. I mean, Cy Young happened to be an FBI agent and went back to that and then went into something else. Horace Oschenfelter, again, lived a very private life.
You might have it backwards.
I know. Horace Oschenfelter was in the FBI. You're right about that. And Cy Young became a farmer. But they both just turned their back and went on with their lives and their careers. And they didn't really, stay to try to perpetrate their celebrity in any way. That was just something that was in their youth and they moved on. So now it's different, right? Mm-hmm. Now the Olympics, a lot of it is the celebrity aspect of the Olympics. Now you have people on national television who capture the attention and then try to make the most of it because they've invested so much in it. And so you have, for example, I looked this up. More than 20 Olympic athletes have been on Dancing with the Stars, which is exactly what you'd expect. I mean, it's a matter of living in celebrity culture. And there's, in some ways, no better example of that than the movie we have out now, which is, I, Tanya, about Tanya Harding and what celebrity culture and what the stakes were at that point in time and her accomplishment with Nancy Kerrigan. Of course, that's the story of... her competing with Nancy Kerrigan to be the preeminent U.S. skater and to possibly win the Olympics. And there is the attack on Nancy Kerrigan on her knee is hit by someone who's out to do her no good. She's able to compete, but she's injured. Is Tanya implicated? Was she part of the plot? And then Tanya goes downhill after that. She is basically in disrepute after that. And she becomes part of the so-called celebrity culture in an unsuccessful way. So that becomes part of the Olympic story. How do you cope with that early success, and what is your life about after you achieve what you do in terms of being on the national stage? And Tanya Harding has always represented the downside of that, and I do want to see that movie. It's kind of interesting. We were talking...
People seem to be enjoying it.
Yeah,
Sadie gives it a good review.
The Times has a very interesting article about Tanya Harding. They talk about the movie, too, and the movie apparently gives a... It's not totally positive about Tanya Harding. It's kind of mixed.
Ambiguous. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they play up the notion and they contradict the fact that she had a very tough childhood. She had a very difficult mother, which is to put it in a nice way. And she succeeded against a lot of economic odds, and that's what she was fighting. And perhaps she wasn't given the respect that she was due. And at the same time, it's pretty open to the fact that she's not the most reputable person in the world, maybe not the most reliable in terms of her giving an honest account of events. And she has some connection with what happened to Nancy Kerrigan. So it's clearly a mixed bag. What's interesting about the very in-depth interview in the Times is the author, I thought, seemed to come to terms with this in a very interesting way, in a way that resonated with me and the way I deal with people and deal even with clients at the law firm, is that sometimes you're dealing with people who clearly can't bring themselves to tell you the truth, even at the same time that they're acknowledging they're not going to lie. They can't say they did X. They can't say they lied about X, but they won't say the opposite. And you just have to understand that that's their limitation. And yet, you move on, you deal with these people, and that doesn't mean these people have nothing to offer. That doesn't mean that they aren't reliable in other respects. It doesn't mean that they don't have explanations for what they did. And that's what this article is about.
You feel it presented her in a more positive light?
The article definitely presented her in a more positive light. And even...
Because she's not very appealing.
Maybe not. She actually says to her in the movie, is there anything about the movie that you didn't like? And the movie, again, casts her in a somewhat dishonest light in some respects. And she says, yeah, you know what I didn't like about that? It sort of suggested that I was making my fur coats out of animals that I hunted. And, I bought those coats.
Okay.
but
she does love to hunt.
But she does love to hunt, which is fine. A lot of people love to hunt. But anyway, I found it kind of interesting. But it kind of takes us to movies. And one of the advantages of having Ellie here is Ellie has seen movies that we haven't seen. And we've seen some big movies, so has Ellie. So Ellie, you were telling us that, first of all, you've seen Dunkirk.
Yes.
And we haven't seen that. What do you think of Dunkirk?
I thought it was excellent. It had been a while, I guess, since I've seen a movie that doesn't really have a firm protagonist. I mean, it has, main characters, but it's more about all of the people on the beach and on the boats. And, I mean, it was obviously very visually stunning. The music by Hans Zimmer was excellent and very, in the moment.
Yeah, and no, a lot of people love that.
It was just, cinematography was very good.
And you've seen Star Wars also. What do you think of that?
Yeah. I actually was not a huge fan of the Last Jedi.
But are you a Star Wars person?
I am absolutely a Star Wars person, so I was very disappointed that that I didn't love it.
Oh, that's too bad.
Did you
see Thor?
I did, yeah. Oh, that's right. I loved Thor.
Yeah.
Well, we saw Thor too. We saw Thor too. We haven't talked about it here, and it was fun. It was crazy.
Yeah.
But I guess that's the idea.
It was just funny from start to finish, which they had never done in a Marvel movie before, kind of with Guardians of the Galaxy, but even more so.
It was funny, and I thought that guy was pretty jacked, actually. He seemed to be pretty built up. He seemed to lift a little bit.
We saw a lot of fun movies this year. Remember Baby Driver?
Baby Driver was great,
and...
The Big Sick.
Big Sick.
Ellie saw The Big Sick.
Yep.
Which is fun. It's just a nice...
Yeah.
Relationship movie, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I had a good time at Loving Vincent.
I didn't see that, but I heard that that's a fascinating premise.
I also saw an interesting Japanese film. It's probably been out a few years. It's animated, and it was called Your Name. Did you hear about that?
I might watch that tonight. I just got it on Blu-ray. I watched the first 20 minutes on a plane, and I had already heard about
it. Kansas Soda on a plane.
Yeah, so it's not available like streaming anywhere, so I bought the Blu-ray, and I'm actually probably going to watch that tonight.
All right, so Tams is coming over tonight.
But I saw the first 20 minutes, and I thought it was very good.
It's interesting, and it really...
I've read about it.
It has earned $335 million.
Yeah.
Okay, The Shape of Water is going to earn like $20 million.
Yeah.
So that gives you an idea of the scope, and it's about two adolescents who kind of switch lives, and it's interesting and fantastical, but I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, the movie that now is on my radar in a way it wasn't before was Call Me By Your Name. All because we went to a bar on Friday night, as Tams and I want to do. And guy there mentioned that, who directed it. And just take a step back. Here's the story.
Well, we were talking about all our favorite films.
Right. We were.
And he mentioned that this one was really worth seeing.
Right. So,
and he said part of the reason he went to see it was because he really loved...
The director. The director is named Luca Guadagnino.
Mm-hmm.
An Italian director, and apparently this is the third movie in a trilogy, the first two being movies that we thought were great. The first one being I Am Love, with Tilda Swinton. The second one being A Bigger Splash with Tilda Swinton and Ralph Fiennes. Those were great movies.
Yeah.
So if this
I Am Love takes place in Milan.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful and has... one of my favorite cemeteries in it,
uh-huh.
The Milan Cemetery.
Do you know where
Bigger
Splash takes place?
I don't exactly remember.
It was all over the place.
The location.
Yeah, but they did some traveling.
Beautiful. They're all exquisite.
Yeah, and these are great movies, so we have to see Call Me By Your Name. And, of course, there are some other big movies we haven't seen also, like Phantom Thread's coming up, The Post, and I, Tanya. So we have that.
So we've got our work cut out for us.
Yes, we do.
And now that football is winding down, maybe we'll get a chance to do that.
Yes, it's football. Okay. It's the problem.
Fun article in the Wall Street Journal about the many benefits of the occasional swear word. And it quotes that, there have been studies, a recent study actually shows that people can withstand 50% more time of their, their hands submerged in ice water if they swear.
Really?
When it's happening.
They
feel less pain, they're able to keep it in longer. It's a very effective pain reliever.
Right.
Also relieves social pain. People feel better when they've been in social situations and experience rejection or whatever, if they curse about it. The article does mention that you could take Tylenol after having a social issue and feel better too, but it might just be cheaper and healthier to curse.
They also say it kind of girds you for physical activity, that you can push yourself harder, you can lift more weight when you're cursing.
But it can't be pseudo curse words.
It can't be
frickin' or fudge.
No,
it's got to be the real thing.
The real curse words, the kind we can't use here, but yes.
And the shock value is important. So perhaps if you're too comfortable with cursing, it won't have as powerful an impact. And Ellie was saying that there was another article a year ago or something.
Yeah, there was, I can't remember exactly. There was one from last summer and a couple just from earlier, which actually cited the same study, but also there was some book where they found out, or they thought that it was linked to intelligence, that if you curse, you might be smarter. There was a curse words can help you more accurately communicate your emotions. That sort of thing. Timothy Jay, an emeritus professor at Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, said there must be evolutionary advantages to cursing or would not have evolved to do it.
Okay.
So, yeah, so we're all to cursing.
Cursing is great.
So, yeah, it says...
Everybody says so.
The Wall Street Journal article sums up by saying, swearing is powerful stuff. A little can go a long way.
That's so right.
So keep that in mind.
And more cursing goes
even
farther.
We're not advocating just...
Yes, we are.
Irresponsible swearing.
Well, I tell you, so if you want to see swearing, really effective swearing, if you happen to see that Alabama-Georgia game on Monday and you were watching Nick Saban on the sidelines, that was about very effective swearing. And that was a fascinating game because Alabama fell behind in the first half and they were kind of hopelessly drifting, doing nowhere on offense. And what Saban did was something he had no choice but to do. He replaced the quarterback and put in a freshman quarterback.
So you found that shocking?
No, I didn't find it shocking, especially in reading about
it. You were telling him to do it through the TV.
I was telling you to do it, okay. But you weren't doing it. But Saban did it.
You've got
to
get rid of the quarterback.
Look, I've watched this. Yeah. Here's what it's a combination of watching the game and what I've learned since, and here's where I am at this point with this. It was shocking in some respects that you would put in a freshman quarterback as a replacement for the quarterback who went 24-2 over the last two seasons in the middle of the championship
game. A true freshman,
like 18, 19 years old. But here's the deal. Here's why it's a little less shocking than you might think. Number one is this fella had a big rep when he signed. Number two is he had been playing a lot in practice, and the coaching staff had concluded weeks ago he was the better quarterback.
Uh-huh.
And frankly, I've been watching the other quarterback, and that doesn't surprise me. And number three, he had no choice. He had no choice. The game was going nowhere, and that's the only circumstance under which he was going to be able to put him in comfortably. If anything, Saban screwed up. They should have groomed this quarterback. He should have been in 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Mm.
The fact that the other quarterback had gone 24-2 doesn't mean anything. Alabama only plays 2 or 3 competitive games a year.
Mm.
They're really winning every other game by 30 points. So this fellow should have been groomed and ready. Because he wasn't groomed, then you got to see the Nick Saban cursing fest. Because he did things that you have never seen a football player do in a national game, which were just crazy. He threw an interception on a running play, which means every player on his team had their back to him when he threw the ball, and the only people facing the ball were the defenders, and they intercepted.
So that's inexperience.
Inexperience puts a shine on it. Yes, it was unbelievable. He didn't understand what the play clock meant. He committed the worst faux pas you can in overtime, where you start with a ball in field goal territory, you need that field goal, and he turned around and ran in the wrong direction and lost 20 yards. He did crazy, crazy things that a freshman would do. And
not his fault, because they hadn't
trained
him. But I think we ought to call him by his name.
It is, and here it is. It's Tua Tagovailoa. How's that?
No. Tua Tagovailoa.
Okay, I'll go with that. But, you know, and he'll get better. But, you know, the Alabama coaching staff probably would have done him a favor by playing a little more during the season. He played a little bit, but not very much. And yet, they got him in just in the nick of time. It was a very exciting game, and Nick got to do that some very effective cursing.
It was a very exciting game.
It was.
And anybody can be a Sunday morning quarterback.
Yes, in this case, it would be Tuesday morning.
Tuesday morning quarterback.
That's a little
tougher. But it's Sunday now.
It's Sunday now.
And you're giving this information.
I was saying at the time. Was I not telling you to take money?
You were, actually.
Yes, I was.
That is true.
Thank you.
Okay, so here we have a story about some people who probably don't curse at all.
Right.
And that would be the Amish and the Mennonites.
Right.
And up in the Finger Lake region, there are big traffic issues, traffic safety issues, and it's because of all the buggies. Right, the Amish buggies are causing accidents. Cars come around the turn, come up behind them, and by the time they see them, it's almost too late to stop. And because these buggies are just made of, you know, a few little pieces of wood and some fabric, they fly apart at the slightest touch. And they don't have lights. They are black, so they're hard to see. And, you know, people, you know, they're trying to improve safety, give more safety education to the eighth graders they are training to drive them. But not everybody believes in that kind of, well, safety is one thing. Lights and orange decorations, triangles or whatever, are kind of discouraged. Some of them say it's too bright and flashy. God yeah, is not that
yeah,
way.
You got a, yeah, a more fundamental problem there.
And whereas the one local policeman says, you and I might use things like airbags and seat belts, but they put their lives in God's hands.
That's the problem.
And depend on God.
Yeah, so the problem is, so when they have an accident and somebody dies, they say, well, that person must have been very good that God called them home so early. So if you have that kind of perspective on the world, you're not really into safety features. And
they also feel that a crashed buggy is easier to get out of than a crashed car, so they feel safer in the buggy.
There's a lot of strange things they believe. But the, so we have that at the same time that we have this bit of news from General Motors. There's an article in the Times which says that General Motors is looking to driverless cars in use in, get ready, 2019. That's right, driverless cars next year. Next year, you're going to have cars available and you're going to see them on the road in certain cities with no steering wheel. And people are going to be sitting there facing the center, gabbing, and the car is driving itself.
I think this is a huge step forward. I think I will be so much more relaxed seeing grandparents in a driverless car than in the driverless cars they've been driving previously.
Listen, it's got great possibilities.
You know what I'm saying? Yes. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I agree with that. I also think driverless buggies would be a good thing. But my point really is, it's just mind-boggling. See, at the same time that we're still talking about the Amish driving these buggies, we're talking about driverless cars. Can you imagine if in 3 or 4 years...
The diversity of our technology today is magnificent. I'm glad that we still embrace that, you know, the slow ride in addition to the easy ride.
Well, I don't know if we embrace it. But I mean, I think that's crazy. You know, I've been hearing these stories for a long time and I thought it was way in the future. And apparently
that's like,
it's
you
not.
Know, that's like you still using your flip phone.
I don't use a flip phone.
Well, you know, for the last year, but
I'm on top of
you're right in there with the Amish.
No, not
on
really.
Some technology.
Not really. Not really. Ellie, dog sniffing art?
Yeah, so the in Boston, they have a new
the Museum
idea.
Of Fine Arts, right? Is trying an experiment?
Yeah, so they have Riley, who is a 12-week-old Weimaraner, who they're going to train to detect pests in the artwork.
I'm sorry, what kind of dog was that?
He's a Weimaraner.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
That's easy for you to say.
Weimaraner.
The article starts, say hello to Riley. He is a good boy.
Yeah.
So it's a trial project. They've never done it before, and yet the Museum of Fine Arts. So because dogs' noses are so, you know, powerful, and they use them for all kind of stuff, explosives, bed bugs, cadavers.
Drugs, yeah. Cancer.
They, drugs, they yeah, cancer now, too.
They seem to...
They figured, I guess, that this was the next step. For what dogs could do for us. It looks like a museum employee just adopted this dog and said, hey, let's train it to find pests. So they'll train the dog to smell out the pests, and then the dog will be trained to sit in front of the artwork that has pests and let them know that they're there.
But they caution that they're not going to be there. I think it'd be kind of cool to have the dogs just roaming around in the museum. While the rest of them are there.
Yeah,
but
it says Riley will mostly be doing his work during the off hours, but he's already very popular since they've introduced him to the local media, so they're hoping to do some kind of thing for Riley's many fans. People do love dogs and puppies.
And it just shows you, again, the amazing things that animals are capable of.
And
the idea that they can sniff those things out when it would just be impractical or, you know, for us to even do it with... technology. So that would be great. So I hope that works out.
If that's successful, and then maybe they can push that to other museums as well.
Yeah. Maybe Riley's doing a lot for dogs, but dingoes, on the other hand, are bad news. Dingoes in Australia are a real problem.
Well, what are dingoes?
Dingoes are
like wild dog things?
Yes, they're wild dog things.
Okay.
Exactly right. They're wild dog things who are incapable of sniffing out insects and art. They're just ne'er-do-wells. And in Australia, they're a huge problem. And they prey on sheep that's herded in all the sheep farms in Australia. So the Australian solution for this was to build a fence, a 30...
A wall.
A wall, yes. Let me give
the
you
the dingo wall.
The dingo wall. It is a 3,500 mile long dingo fence. They call it a dingo fence. And it keeps the dingoes from the sheep, or so it tries. And this is a serious economic problem. Even with the fence up, the losses associated with sheep attacked by dingoes in Australia last year, $65 million is the estimate. They do the best to keep this fence going.
How do they maintain it?
They have a bunch of guys who spend 20, 30, 40 years in this post, each patrolling a 200-mile piece of the fence out in the so-called outback, like your Subaru. And they live a lonely life.
But so here are my questions. Here are my questions. One, is it attractive?
No.
Two, who paid for it? Did the dingoes pay
the
for it?
The dingoes paid for it. Okay. It's in the Donald Trump mode. The dingoes were forced to put up their own fence.
Yeah.
And apparently the U.S., not the U.S., the Australians have to maintain it. What's your third question? Do you have another question?
I think I did, but I lost it now.
But in any event, it's tough work, and it's lonely work. But apparently folks like it, and they think it's worth doing. Having said that, the environmentalists are already questioning whether the dingo fence has caused proliferation of the kind of animals that the dingoes are counted on to normally take care of, feral cats and the like. On the other
are
side
you really
fence.
Worried about this?
I'm giving you the full report.
You just want Trump to look at this and get
smaller
some ideas,
native,
okay?
Smaller native
you feel
prey.
You need going, some inspiration.
Foxes are going crazy on the wrong side of the fence. But just
Donald, if you're listening,
think about it though. A 3,500 mile long fence.
Enough about the fence. Okay.
I think it's an amazing accomplishment.
Another article in the New York Times pits Victoria against The Crown.
Yes.
Those two television series dramatizing the lives of current British Queen Elizabeth II and her great-grandmother, Queen Victoria. Each features a heroine who feels trapped in her royal role but accomplishes more than is expected of her while massaging the bruised ego of her husband and consort. Each hopscotches through history, cherry-picking crises and triumphs that fit the demands of episodic storytelling. And this article comes out for Victoria, seeming to think Victoria is a lot more fun than the Queen Elizabeth in The Crown. And
yeah.
The Crown, they seem to imply here, is a heavier hitter. It's more loaded with serious, experienced writers.
Right.
And that Victoria is a little more, innovative, creative,
goofy,
fun. Yeah.
Silly, not worth watching.
They like the Prince, this writer, Mike Hale, likes Prince Albert in Victoria, a marked...
Oh,
The broody but well-meaning Prince Albert, as opposed to the conceited simp that Matt Smith makes out of Prince
Philip. I'm with
the
simp.
You like the simp?
Let me ask you. I mean, are you reading this because you're agreeing with the critic's view here?
No, I thought the Victoria was eminently silly.
Yeah. Awful.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was insipid. It had...
So I don't really understand why...
It lost its main character.
People seem to like it, so...
No, I don't know about that.
I'm just putting it out there.
I didn't know that... I should have suspected that Victoria was the great-grandmother of Elizabeth.
They're all related. That's the way the monarchy works.
Well, until you said it, I said to myself, they have nothing to do with each other. And then you said they're related. I said, what a coincidence. And now it turns out that it makes perfect sense to me.
They're all related.
Well, what's odd is that it looks to me like the Victoria character is even younger than the Elizabeth character. But you're going to tell me that it takes place in a different time. Yeah. All right. So, let me just say three words in The Crown. Watch it. I like The Crown. Super.
Three words. Watch it.
Watch it. Super.
Watch it soon.
Watch it.
Watch it now.
All right. Go on to something even more artsy. I turned you on to this. This production of Pinocchio.
Yeah, there's a production of Pinocchio in London. Of course, in London. At the National Theatre.
Right.
And it's actually a...
It looks great.
An adaptation of the 1940s animated.
Right.
Disney Pinocchio with the songs.
With the songs.
So that's a lot of fun.
Is Jiminy Cricket in it?
Jiminy Cricket is in it.
Jiminy Cricket.
The same story, the same characters,
right.
and but they use puppets.
Right.
The main character, the Pinocchio, is
a real boy.
Human,
a real boy.
A real boy, and then they have all these huge,
right,
really huge puppets playing the other characters.
Because the boy has to look like a boy.
Yeah, right. And they actually give it a very good review. Not everybody apparently goes for it. Some people are worried that it's a little too scary for children. But Ben Bradley points out that the writers here understand that childhood innocence is neither as sweet nor as simple as sentimentalists would like you to believe. And the people working on it actually also worked on Matilda. And Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. And so there is... Matilda was a great musical. You didn't see it.
No.
I saw it. It was a lot of fun.
You saw it in London.
And dark in many ways, but that's part of what it made delightful for an adult as opposed to...
Well, you know, the other thing he compares it to The Lion King and Julie Taymor's production, Lion King. I had a friend who recently took his child to see The Lion King, and he's a guy who's seen a lot of opera. Julie Taymor does a lot of opera also, and he was stunned at how wonderful the puppets are, and the papier-mâché type figures in The Lion King. And this sounds like it's just, you know, the same type of thing.
And he says the music actually works. The songs only occasionally are given the kind of razzle-dazzle you associate with big musicals. Instead, they seem to sweep gently in and out of your awareness. That's appropriate, Bradley says, to a show that feels conjured from those dark corners of a child's imagination that even grown-ups never entirely erase. So,
I remember the music was very good.
That sounds like a winner.
All right, so we have we just wanted to talk briefly about a Times issue recently. I think it was Thursday, that an article on both Peloton and Flywheel, in particular the models that you could have at home. And it was on...
So explain what Peloton is.
Peloton is a service as much as it is a bicycle. It's going to be a treadmill
soon. Well, it's a very expensive
also.
Bicycle. You have very to have the bicycle, but you have to also pay...
Right. So you pay close to $2,000 for a stationary bicycle. But the trick is, and the marketing bit is, that you are signed up for the feed of the Peloton classes. So while you're pedaling away...
You have a screen.
And you have a leader, and the classes are happening in real time. So supposedly,
and there's interaction.
Yeah, interaction.
So, and people get attached to the instructors. The instructors are like rock stars.
Well, actually, Flywheel is almost a better way to discuss that, because Flywheel's come up with the same thing now. Now, Flywheel started out as a studio thing in New York and similar places. I think Ellie, is it out here now, Flywheel? Or
I'm not sure.
SoulCycle might be out here. Something's out here. It's the same idea. With this kind of thing that Tams is talking about. Instructors with real followings. People go to the class. They play, you know, kind of peppy music. The instructor exhorts them. They might even know other people in the class. And it's a great workout. And it's 45
minutes. Yeah, we've heard about this before.
Right.
People jockey for position to be up near
the instructor.
But that's the starting point.
So now you're getting it on your screen.
Yeah.
So now you're getting it both Flywheel and Peloton has no studio class. Peloton is all about doing it off.
But people are connected.
Right. They must have some studios. But in any event, so the idea they're comparing is the experience at home following the screen versus being in the studio, or just put another way, does it make sense to have this bike at home and sign up for this? Because you're spending $40 a month to get the feed, and you're spending close to $2,000 for the bike. And they do the pros and cons, and the pros and cons are it's worth it if you go enough. Because if you don't use it, you spent a lot of money on nothing. And also, if you're in Manhattan, you've got a bicycle taking up a third of your apartment.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit of a problem, too. But the other advantage is of going to class is that you see people. And they make the point that
there's no gossip.
There's no gossip.
I mean, with the Peloton, you do develop these this engagement with the instructor, and yeah. people love the instructors, etc. But you're not, you know, you're not walking to class with anybody yes. or seeing other people next to you or chatting yes. with them, catching up on the gossip.
We should ask Ellie, what's the strikes you as better, Ellie, in the apartment for going to classes?
I think it's better to go out into the world to get your exercise.
Yeah.
To get that social factor.
Yeah, I tend to think there's something to that.
Unless you can't go out for whatever reason, if you're really super busy and you just can't.
Yeah.
leave to make that commute, then it can make more sense to do it in the house. But
well, you're an in-the-house guy.
Yeah. I'm an in-the-house guy just because I'm doing it at 5 in the morning and because I'm a disagreeable guy. So, well, I have a whole different view. I work
but
out.
But anyway,
I don't use music, all that stuff. But
Peloton is making a ton of money. So,
yeah, Peloton's so far, catching so on. I think where they're vulnerable is because it's easy to compete with them.
So it's trying to be a little bit of both. You've got the convenience of doing it in your home, but you are connecting
that's exactly right.
with other people.
That's exactly right. And that's the social media solution to the problem, right?
Yeah.
You're sitting on your couch and you're connecting with people in that way.
Okay.
But it's not like being in person. But it is catching on. That tells us something about the way people choose to interact, to be sure. But you had something, Tamsin, about...
Well, there's a review of a new book about the story of Stanford White... Evelyn Nesbitt and Harry Thaw, called The Girl on the Velvet Swing. It's by Simon Batts. And it's, you know, that shocking murder of the century where you have the sophisticated, renowned, successful Beaux-Arts architect Stanford White having dalliances with various young girls, including Evelyn Nesbitt, who was the model mm-hmm. for many artists of the time, including Charles Dana Gibson. I mean, she is the Gibson girl, among other things. And he actually supposedly deflowers her. He invites girls up to Stanford White, has girls up to his apartment mm-hmm. above F.A.O. Schwartz on West 24th
There's
Street.
There's something wrong about that, but yeah.
Yeah, ahead. Yeah. She is a model, but she's also in some, you know, Broadway shows, some vaudeville shows. She was a Floradora girl. This guy, this wealthy young man, Harry Thaw, sees her and falls in love with her. The problem is he's a little bit insane, but eventually he does convince her to marry him. And even after she admits that she is not a virgin, of course, he is completely upset about that. But they get married, and one night when they're out to dinner, Stanford White walks in
right.
and sits near them, and Harry just gets up and shoots him.
Right.
So,
but it's a notorious story.
And, you know, and he will be right. committed for the rest of his life. There are various trials, and they will get divorced. She, you know, does a few vaudeville shows, whatever, ekes out some kind of a living, but basically spends the rest of her life in obscurity.
Like Tonya Harding, basically.
But it's a, you know, a story that gripped people more than once, including a 1955 film starring a young Joan Collins
right.
As Evelyn Nesbitt, and Ray Milland as White, and Farley Granger as the crazy Harry Thaw. So it's most notable for she is beautiful and glamorous looking, and she certainly looked quite extraordinary when she was very young.
Well, we should also say it's also the subject of ragtime.
Yes.
And the book and, right. And the musical. But you were saying something about the fact that White was a real architect, though. That he, you know, had some substantial accomplishments as an architect.
Yeah, the Washington Square Arch. Tiffany Building, mansions
yeah.
in Newport, and
so,
other places for the Astors and the Vanderbilts,
yeah.
the Century Club.
Well, that,
I mean, he was legit, but he had this whole other dark side.
No, I understand, but that makes the story that much more interesting. Just the idea that some guy, you know.
Again, we're with that conflict
yeah.
of where do you put people's
accomplishments?
You know,
yeah, if they're turned out
against
to be
their
libertines.
Morals, yeah,
right. Well.
And can we still appreciate?
So this is a new book about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So you had something about how one puts...
Well, we like to give out some words of wisdom
yeah.
now and then to help you get through life. And the New York Times has a little blurb about how to build a ship in a bottle.
Yeah.
And
sounds difficult. I've always wondered about that.
And their advice is start with the right bottle. I think we can apply that to many things.
All right. Well, speaking of starting with the right bottle, I think we should end our show, it's only fair, with a salute to the Philadelphia Eagles. Last week we
I never thought I'd see you saluting the Philadelphia Eagles.
I am, if nothing else, fair-minded.
You heard it here first, folks.
Well, listen, we acknowledged last week the Sixers by playing the Sixers fight song, and we wanted to do the same with respect to the Eagles, because the Eagles went and won their first playoff game yesterday. In which they were the underdog.
Yes, against all odds.
Against all odds.
Literally.
Yes. And so here we go. And they play this all the time when you're at an Eagle game. That's right. Fly, Eagles, fly. Every time the Eagles score a touchdown, the whole crowd sings Fly, Eagles, fly. And we saw the tape yesterday of the crowd spilling out of the stadium after the victory. And maybe they were drunk, and maybe they were cold, but they were ecstatic. And that was real. That's 60,000 people in total joy singing this in their heads. Well, congratulations, Eagles.
That's all for today from Tamsin.
And Dan.
And Tamsin and Dan read the paper.
Thanks.